Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest is the writer Thomas Page McBee. Thomas Page McBee writes the column Self-Made Man for the Rumpus. His essays and journalism have appeared or are forthcoming in TheAtlantic.com, The New York Times, Salon, Vice, The Utney Reader, The San Francisco Weekly, and The Phoenix in Boston, where he is an editor. His manuscript, This Fragile Fortress, a memoir about crime, forgiveness, and what makes a man, won the Mary Tenenbaum Nonfiction Award from the San Francisco Foundation and was a finalist for the 2012 Bakeless Literary Prize. Hi, Thomas. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Do you want to start us off with some reading?
Yeah, so I'm going to be reading a few pieces from my Self-Made Man series on the Rumpus, which is a way that I got interested in exploring counter-narratives to masculinity. So I wanted to create a counter-narrative to heteronormative masculinity, and that's where I started with this. So this one is number 17. It's called Real Men. If masculinity could be defined by a quick Google search or a drive down a billboard-studded highway, then a real man is a paradox, captured crudely at the uneasy intersections of faith, love, public service announcements, politics, and advertising. Real men love God, buy American, work hard, don't hit women, have integrity, stay faithful, wear pink, don't wear pink, are kind to animals, fight to the death. What makes a man? When I started testosterone, I posed this winking refrain, but the notion of real men still stung, each joke t-shirt and black and white bus stop admonishment a nick on my heart. No one's a real man, I figured, but most definitely not me, with my weekly shot and unique plumbing. What makes a man? As I grew more confident, the question remained the crux of my core anxiety. I'd spent 29 years struggling against a bad translation. I wanted to be my own man, to comb my hair with brill cream, to tailor my jeans, grow a beard, wear a shirt. This is what a feminist looks like. We all get the message of what a man is meant to be, but unlike feminism's unbraiding of the ideal feminine, hypermasculinity sits like an elephant on steroids, stinking up the living room. It's complex to examine what being a man means because most of us, whether we realize it or not, are committed to a monolithic answer. We might pretend we're not all engaging with the mixed message at the heart of our every interaction. We value masculinity in all bodies because we value men more than women. Conversely, those of us who'd like to disengage with patriarchal, problematic stereotypes of maleness, even a little bit, are undermined and satirized, bullied and belittled. Every man I care about is troubled by other men, but there's still a Stockholm Syndrome feel to the framing, a shrugging, "That's just how guys are. That's just how guys are." I've been on testosterone for 16 months. After the muscles bloomed, after my beard began to appear, after my calves widened and my jaw squared out, after I mastered the politics of the men's room, after I learned not to take personally the newly cool greetings of women strangers, a pattern began to emerge. The elephant was real, trumpeting its answer to what makes a man. Here I was becoming one, forming at bars and backyard barbecues and work meetings, confronted at every turn with an expectation and whether or not I would meet it. What makes a man? Here I was, not the question, but the answer. My brother and I grew up in a house where one man's failure defined masculinity for the both of us. Our father, who abused me, was domineering and manipulative, double-crossing and compulsive. Later, I would come to see that he was also lonely, lost and scared, a link in a chain of male violence that ended, turns out, with me. Men, my mom would say, a single word that held the universe of her rage, everything we needed to know in the way it was bathed in acid. In elementary school, my little brother would sometimes tear up his room, blank-eyed and sleepwalking. After years of bullies, B went to the gym and grew chiseled, played varsity hockey, then American dreamed his way into a .com. In college, he made a bronze sculpture of a grown man crouched with his arms around his knees. "You remember?" he asked me once, and it was the kind of man he became that allowed me to believe in something better than our father. I told him last April in a bar in the Mission of my plans to take testosterone back when I also lived in San Francisco. I couldn't figure out why, but I was more nervous to tell him than anyone else. That's a lie. I was nervous to tell him for the ways I'd grown up projecting my father onto his little kid frame, seeing their similar grins as proof of something dark. I sat in that bar waiting for his "I told you so." He knew intimately the ways I misunderstood myself. He smiled wide, shrugged. "I've been saying my whole life that you're a guy," he said. That was that. We ordered another round. He reported some work trouble, and we were like the brothers we were meant to become, if I'd only been paying attention. Still, a sticking point for us is his interest in the destiny of biology, the reassuring essentialist refrain of "men are from Mars, women are from Venus." Sometimes his understanding of me feels limited by hormones and science, the framework that helps him understand his maleness. But as he tells me how terrified he was of becoming a monster growing up, I begin to understand the comfort of biology. Being a boy, the strange rush of testosterone, the two-faced dad, He worried he was broken, much in the way I did. I watched him spend hours at the Y and come home calmer. I feel it too, the need to make muscle to guard the pinkest, most scared parts of myself. There's something to pushing all that anger and confusion into a weight that can bear it. I struggle with the fact that I was a guy. I think it's been a lifetime struggle, he said, when I asked to interview him for this piece. It makes me curious how many men are fighting similar fights, shadowboxing the worst aspects of maleness, trying to grow into something sweet from the toxic waste of inheritance. I asked him how he feels about other men, if he's suspicious of them in the way the world has taught us to be suspicious of ourselves. A guy that doesn't show any emotion, that's scary. I think of our father, his silence, his far-off stare. I think of how, almost always, naming what scares you is the primary way to avoid becoming it. I'm very upfront with people, B said, as if an answer. They know how I feel. Before I transitioned, the struggles of the men in my life felt gritty and strange to me, a little unwashed. They get uncomfortably vulnerable over beers, easily crushed about fathers and exes especially, like animals without shells. It was a little foreign and often so raw I'd leave wondering how it was possible that the young women I knew seemed so much more resilient in reclaiming their identities in a world of intense violence and inequity, while the men seemed genuinely baffled as to how to make it all add up to something meaningful. How naive I see now to think the crush of gender expectations only affects the most obviously oppressed. What makes a man? Every man I've known well enough to get a little drunk with has eventually addressed the dilemma, how to be yourself in a world that expects a monster or a hero. So the crush shell seemed to me eventually to be about claustrophobia, the way that the sexism underpinning hypermasculinity is a vice grip on even the most rebellious among us. To be your own man is to acknowledge that you're not real unless everyone's real, that all the power located in monolithic masculinity is a house of cards, but on your back and you, pulling yourself out of the stack, are helping to upend the whole foundation. We eat peanuts, drink beer in San Francisco, Pittsburgh, Boston. A guy tells me upon his marriage that his mother reminded him to be good to his wife. A real man respects women, says the ad campaign, which only exists to tell us exactly what real men have failed to do, a reminder of what isn't expected. A memory. In Napa for his birthday a few years ago, before I was on testosterone, I looked up my brother's astrological chart. This is a thing I do, inevitably, at parties and birthdays and long car rides. Anyway, I told him he was a Cancer rising, started to read the description off my phone as we drank coffee near the French Laundry, surrounded by tourists despite the drizzle. What does that mean, he asked, his aviators mirroring myself back to me. It says you're imaginative, I told him, and sensitive, and nurturing. He looked chiseled and young, a little out of place still, living in a city after so many years in wintry industrial towns. I could see in the months since he'd arrived that he was becoming himself. I'm nurturing, he echoed, his thick arms crossed across his chest. He turned to his girlfriend. I'm nurturing, he told her. Since I transitioned, I've revisited that moment, my surprise at his enthusiasm, the emphatic way he announced it, the pride in his voice. What a reward it must have seemed to him to be seen as the man he was, not the father he was afraid of becoming, but the person he'd grown out of thousands of reps and all those cracked shell moments when the vice squeezed too hard. Here he was, the person he'd been all along. I'm nurturing, he said, shaking his head. Did you know that about me? We were leaning against a car, the two realest men you know, and of course I said yes.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the writer Thomas Page McBee, reading from his work, Self-Made Man. One of the first things that impresses me immediately about your work is this really strong sense of compassion. Self-Made Man really investigates masculinity and starts to sort of dissect this thing that I think in a lot of ways seems very rigid. We hear a lot that men are simple. And then you go in and sort of expose the complexity of it. And I think you hear a lot in this piece about vulnerability. At first, you're introduced to this brother who, you know, apprehensive about his judgment. And then at the end, you're finding this like really soft side where he's really sort of glowing with this idea that he's nurturing. You have this moment of, you know, allowing the abusive father his own fear, his own shortcomings that maybe that came out of. Can you talk about that, about the vulnerability and about exploring sort of this shadow side or this unseen side of masculinity?
Yeah, I think I'm really interested in vulnerability just in general. It's been to me like a really life-saving concept and to think of things through a compassionate lens rather than sort of a rigid lens. I think because maybe I've experienced a lot of things that made me feel really different than other people. I mean, being transgender and just coming from an abusive household. And I think as I got older, a lot of what interested me was looking for first other people who felt other, and then actually over time realizing that everybody feels kind of other I think masculinity, and especially now being in the circumstance where I'm sort of moving in the world amongst, you know, heteronormative, straight New England guys, like sort of looking at those places where I think there's a sort of assumption of that, you know, that being in this sort of most dominant position maybe somehow makes you immune from being vulnerable, or maybe there's this desire maybe for other people to want you to believe that about them. And I think actually common humanity comes from being able to see vulnerability in other people, even people who are oppressing you or who are in positions of power. And it's interesting because I think in terms of my work, a lot of people who've responded to my writing have been guys who've said things like, you know, I was a football player and I was in a frat and I did all these different things and it took me a really long time to learn, you know, what you're talking about right now, you know? So I think it's something that people really are thinking about these things, men too, but it's not always something that's talked about. So I just got really interested in, I guess, kind of finding some way to de-other myself by seeing what I had in common with people. And I always look for that. I look for myself and others.
It comes across a lot. There's a real sense of acceptance of people, like a human community that comes across in the work.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the writing of that? Like in this piece and throughout the series, there's a fair amount of skipping around in time. There's, you know, skipping from different interactions with loved ones or strangers. And then you have this whole project of, you know, examining something like masculinity, which is huge.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how you break that down into a piece, like how you decide what goes in and put it together?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know. I think there's something, I get interested in an idea, like a thematic idea, you know? So like right now, I'm working on the next Self-Made, which I think is going to be on the idea of dignity. Initially, I guess, when I was first doing these, I was looking at really specifically, you know, interacting with the world as a man and how different that felt and where those differences, I felt them the most, and sort of wanting to almost meditate on those places. And now I think I'm almost more, I think because people who are reacting to this stuff tend to be actually people of any stripe who are kind of, I think, thinking about identity at all. Mm. It's allowed me to see even more broader vision around this stuff. So I think I just get interested in like being a person in the world, what am I coming up against? And so I've dealt with passing, which I think, you know, when you're transgender, like that's like obviously very specifically an issue, but then I think everybody passes and I think everybody comes up against that. So I guess what I do first is think of what's something I'm struggling with or dealing with right now, or something that's coming up for me a lot. And then I kind of, I think of a story or a moment and I use that as the frame. And then I just, when I'm writing it, I think a bunch of stuff sort of just starts coming together. I'd spend a lot of time like thinking and thinking and thinking on these, probably like a few weeks. And then I write them. And then the revision process is definitely like really intense and several, I'd say a dozen revisions probably.
Wow.
Just to get to a place where things sort of feel like they coalesce into something that makes sense.
Yeah, they often feel, even though there may be some like sort of unresolved examinations in the pieces, craft-wise, they feel very neat.
Oh, yeah, thanks.
Can you read us some more?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Cool. So this is number 18. It's called In Real Life. I used to believe that collapsing the Venn diagram space between the public and private self was the best way to ensure authenticity, like how we know we're not our food porn, party pics, and pouty lips, that we are, in fact, the clammy hand smearing the camera phone. But sometimes we need a reminder. I've changed my mind. I've come to think that the interplay between our constructions and realities are, in fact, the metaphor for what makes identity meaningful. You got me at this angle, and that doesn't make my image a lie any more than passing does. Online, people say IRL, in real life, the distancing code of it hiding the underbelly of need. In real life is where awkward pauses live. I'm in real life with onion breath and too many drinks. I'm a million failures per revelation. I'm not just constructing myself, but absorbing each reflection of who I am, divided by all of your eyes, spinning like a disco ball. In real life, I'm a man, a trans man, an invisible man, walking among you. Is it any surprise that it was a passing queer poet, Walt Whitman, who wrote, "Do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. I am large, I contain multitudes." In real life today, I smell of talcum. I'm with my barber in Jamaica Plain, shooting the breeze. He's a big-bellied Italian guy, a little leather, a little bear, a little old-school New England. Picture the accent, the gruffness. "What do?" he asks, and I say I write. "About what?" "Gender," I tell him, struck by the simplicity of the word, how it can hold me, the man getting his hair clipped, and the me here with you. "You know what would be a good story? Trans guys have been coming in here by the dozens, wanting men's cuts." My mind pinwheels. Which me is he speaking to? The writer? The trans man? The guy in glasses with a fine spray of glimmering gray hairs and a day job in a magazine? You can Google a pristine version of my depths, or you can take me at my face value, and in both cases, you'd be wrong to think you know me. Here's what I think passing is. That moment when one reflection eclipses the rest. The party pick that doesn't reveal the panic attack, the scruff that doesn't tell the story of the needles and the hormones I metabolized to produce it. He's still talking. I work hard to make them feel good about themselves, he says. Them. I hear who I am to him in the pronoun. I look at my face and see the many truths of it. It breaks my heart, he says, shaking his head. These guys, being trapped in the wrong body? It's a question and it hangs there. I'm a man, a trans man, a considered man, a man who doesn't know, in real life, what to say. Something important. At the University of Chicago last month, I gave a talk about taking control of trans narratives and the importance of diverse masculinities in general. It was called Born in the Right Body. Here's what I told the students and not my barber. My body's never been wrong. I'm suspect of such a simplistic translation. After, here are my two favorite questions. Do you ever worry that being trans will define you? How can I, as someone who's not trans, tell a counter-narrative about gender? The barber asked if he could find my writing online, and I said yes. Hello, if you're reading this. This is not a joke. A trans friend goes to the same bar after work most nights. He's a blue-collar guy among other solo blue-collar guys, and they talk about work and relationships, and if they're sloppy enough, maybe their disappointments, or, similarly, their fathers. He says later he wishes he felt right telling these guys he's trans. He says he feels like he's betraying them. This bugs me. Sits heavy in my gut. The word betrayal, of course, but the scene in my mind. This guy drinking beer with some man who wants to know him, and my friend doesn't see his reflection in the other guy's affirmations. I know, because this is how it happens. A guy calls you bro. He says, being a man, I... Guys really do say these things. My friend, though, he doesn't see a refracted version of reality, a facet of himself looking back at him. He sees a betrayal. I want to tell my barber that that's what breaks my heart. Not a guy just starting hormones whose sideburns aren't square, but the sense that we need to warn the world of who we are, that because we have always been defined by the force of our difference, we must now announce it ourselves. There's another way to tell this story. I had the best conversation with a guy I interviewed for an article about masculinity a few weeks back. He was friendly and smart, and he called me brother, not knowing I was trans. He said something about grappling with negative role models growing up and how tough it was to break out of masculine expectations. You're a man, he concluded. You know. And the thing was, I do. No question. The shame of passing is a shame of deferring. You either are or are not the identity projected on you. I think we need to quit feeling obligated to trumpet our multitudes at the start of every interaction. We're all angles anyway, and there's one I might be missing in someone else's interpretation. In real life, I cannot possibly keep up with the construction I've made here for you. I may pass as compassionate or contained. I may be this story, but it's important to note that I'm another one too. So the answers are related. Do you ever worry that being trans will define you? No, I define myself. All I can hope is that you'll stick around. How can I, as someone who's not trans, tell a counter-narrative about gender? By understanding that you too have a gender and a story to tell. Tell it, because if you're not a singular self, then none of us are. There are as many ways to tell this story as there are ways to know me. In real life, my sideburns have grown square. In real life, I'm the only man I'll ever be. And if you are my barber, I'm no more trapped in my body than you, brother.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the writer Thomas Page McBee. So that piece, I think, gets into another vein in this work that is the real intimacy of the voice in it, the real exposing of this interior world and these ideas about self-definition and how we internalize the judgment of others and how we feel about who we are. And then, you know, and this piece also talks about which me is he speaking to, and you'd be wrong to think you know me. So there's a kind of tension between this declaring and this speaking, and then this sort of also like sense of a reserved self that's not exposed here. Can you talk about that? Was it difficult to write about something very personal? How do you navigate that?
It's really interesting because I started the series in January. I started testosterone in June of 2011. And so I started the series in January of 2012. So I was still so much trying to figure out who I was going to be as a man. And I kind of wanted to have this dialogue with this invisible reader of the universe. And the whole thing feels like a dialogue to me. And I think maybe there was a point where it's almost like I started to feel like I was defining myself in this very intense and public way. And it felt important to also make, you know, this sort of point that in doing so, like, that really exactly that, that there are these many ways that I am, just like there are many ways that we all are. And, mm-hmm. you know, like, I feel like the work has really shifted away from what kind of man am I, what does it mean to be a man, and to more like, what does it just mean to be a person? And I'm sort of making myself this sort of experiment and engaging with people in this way. But I also, I guess I just wanted people to understand that even in doing that, and all of us doing that, I think I thought about online and our personas online, because I think we all do that. We engage with the world in these constructed ways, and it doesn't make them not meaningful, but I think it also doesn't mean that we really know each other when that's the only side we know. So I think I wanted to navigate it by making it visible, I guess, is the answer, you know? And I think that's really important, because I love hearing from people, and I love engaging with people who are reading my work. But I think what's interesting is that people are multifaceted. I would never want to stand for an idea or be like this one thing. And I don't want to be a monolithic person. I want to be a complicated person. So I think building an identity where I can be online and be this thing, and then also make that space to be like, it's also okay that you don't really know anything about me at the end of the day. I wanted all of that to be true at once.
Yeah. And something that seems related to me is these moments where the sort of fallibility of you as the speaker are exposed. There's a resistance to like a neat tying up of things, or a resistance to like identifying as a really heroic voice. Like there's the moment in this piece where I don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, almost ironic for this person who's writing
right.
this, like, you know, whole piece examining exactly this interaction that the man and the barber are having. And also there's the moment where you say something like, I can't possibly keep up with this construction that I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that showing of maybe less flattering qualities in work?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I'm also writing a memoir, and, you know, I've worked with teachers and professors who've said, you know, a memoir is never interesting, and, you know, unless the person seems like someone who makes mistakes, or you have to know your own flaws, really. And if you're writing about yourself, you need to be accountable to the reader in that way. So I think maybe I definitely have that idea that I'm bringing to the table, because I think that's true too. I don't, if I'm going to be reading about someone else's life, which is already a kind of a huge thing to ask of another person, it's like, I want to feel like the reason why is because this person's really showing themselves to me for a larger purpose. And to me, it's a spiritual purpose. Like, I think I'm just happen to be a person who, if you meet me in a bar, I'm probably going to have a really intense, long conversation with you about our lives, because that's just how I am. So for me, my writing is going to be that way. And it would be disingenuous to present myself in some sort of neat and tidy package, because I don't think it's interesting. And I also, if my whole point is to open myself up, I want it to be dynamic and complicated, because the whole point is I think we should be having those kinds of conversations more.
Mm-hmm. Can you read us some more?
Yes. So this is number 19, Notes on Negative Space. My story here is as imperfect a facsimile as a snow angel, my body boundaried by words packed tight at my edges. Needles as conduit, forgiveness as belief, love as prize, restrooms as geospiritual locations, identity as metaphor, complicating masculinity. But I'm a body, not a metaphor, and certainly not a static shape. So what I've left out, my raw materials, are more relevant than I allow here. My leg manifests a strange allergy at the sight of my injections. My anger prickles more hot and more often. My empathy is erased easily by minor transgressions. I torpedo my internal, benign, authorial narration with counter-narratives from less empowered times. This year, as I wrote this song of myself, I grew a self-consciousness that lacquered over every night out until I could cocoon myself at home, until the days darkened fast. On the phone, I had the same conversation. I'm great, never been better. I walked into rooms burning with self-consciousness. I'm thinking now that I shouldn't be telling you this, but if you were me 10 years ago or in a different body, I'd want you to know that you're doing it right. It's just easier to be transcendent than it is to be honest. Here's the negative space. I wrote a pretty snow angel of my best self, and then I lay down inside it. I'm a self-made man because I willed myself into existence. I made myself real. In college, I had a professor who taught fiction this way. Imagine a character. Fill in the blank. Thomas is the kind of person who, blank. Here's the good stuff. Is sympathetic to suffering, resistant to cultural norms, thoughtful in small exchanges, measured in conflict. Behind the scenes, of course, there's the harsh rub of this bristling face, the hangnails and wayward cowlicks. Behind the scenes, I'm hurtful. I cry wolf. I fear. I fail. I fail again. I won't write this in the past tense. I fight myself. I give up. I grow impatient. Right now, as you read this, I'm cutting, judgmental, tired. I fantasize about hitting the man ahead of me in line at the grocery store, the man who cuts me off on 95, the man who stares googly-eyed at me, my wife, my friend. I think a lot about the problem of hope. Hope paints a pretty picture of statues that will never be you, but faith pilots you through the messy moments. I'm home alone. I'm doing leg lifts on my chin-up bar in the doorway of my office because the fact is, to have faith, you don't need a story. You need a core. I've known what many people would call evil. Child abuse, a close call with a murderer. I know about other people's dark impulses, and so I've been all the more terrified of my own. I think Carl Jung was equally troubled witnessing Hitler's rise to power. Unlike many of us, he wasn't content to dismiss the despicable as foreign to the human experience. When you bear witness, when you bear the weight of another's actions, even as a victim, you are no longer able to distance yourself, and the arrogance of that position becomes clear. Because where does that leave us, those left to make meaning out of the handprints on our bodies, the guns, the horrors of history? So he designed the shadow theory, that what we repress returns, that we act out our hidden selves. In this case, it's a moral imperative to make oneself vulnerable and to find the familiar and even the unthinkable. He'd say to deny any aspect of humanity is to deny all of it. Jung charged that our work, individually and culturally, is to bring our shadows to light, to integrate what we most fear within ourselves and with the snow angels we create in their place. On a puddle jumper back from Nashville after Christmas, we hit turbulence. A better, cheaper story would claim an epiphany as we bumped over New York, Central Park, visible from our windows, this little life above bearing witness to the little lives below. But that's a conflation. What's close to the truth is that an hour before we could see the city, tiny and twinkling beneath us, before the plane lurched and hiccuped to the sky, I listened to the song that soundtracked my cross-country move from Pittsburgh to San Francisco almost a decade ago. Because I've been shining flashlights in my corners, I remembered everything, the sweaty anticipation, the bittersweet twinge that grew as the landscape changed, the cocky phone calls with the girl I thought I'd marry, how certain I was, how it was the first time I believed in myself, and how I was right. I imagined the body I once had, nestling within this one like a Russian doll. I remembered, too, the hope it held, that if I were just to change hard enough, I could be free of cold sweats and flashbacks, shame and grief, disconnection and fear. Hopeless now, and suspended, shuttling in time and beyond it, I felt a small grace among the sick bags and the hot smell of other people's skin. I thought, I will no longer abandon myself. And then I pictured you, all of you, with your bad breath and fear of failure and bum knees and dashed dreams and credit card debt. I saw you as the plane dropped and lifted, and I thought, as long as we don't crash, I will tell you this.
The work of Thomas Page McBee. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Elisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody 90.5 FM.